I know these are not easy times for libraries and librarians. You are faced with people who are more than willing to come in and tell you what books you ought to get rid of.
And with other people who want you to have all the books and services imaginable, so long as you don't spend any money doing it. And with still other people who think you don't really need books at all anymore. You should just wire up the inside of the building like an electronic jukebox. Well, after a lot of thought about what libraries and librarians are up against these days, I decided just to come here tonight and sing under your window. I don't usually think of myself as a wandering minstrel, yet when I count up the libraries I have been to for the sake of my work, and the literary melodies that have been put into my books by those libraries, something like minstrelsy it seems to be. I took the title for this talk from a friend of mine, another book person, the Missoula writer and teacher of fiction, Bill Kittredge. Kittredge came up with it when he was being interviewed for a book of oral history called The Ranchers, about the changes in his life since he grew up on a ranch of more than 1 million acres down toward Klamath Falls in eastern Oregon. In the landscapes of our minds, we have to learn how we can make a place for ourselves, Bill Kittredge told the interviewer's tape recorder. He went on, I'm much less interested in the world's view of me than in my own past. It's still alive in my head. Even though it's not there anymore, it is. The valley I grew up in was full of horses. And in my head, the horses are still there. I hear them. I hear them. Those of you who have enough trouble with the noise level in your libraries will be relieved that I don't hear horses clattering amid the stacks. But I've heard a lot else, and I want to do you some stanzas of it tonight. So now, quick as this, you are 18 years old. You have come by train, which tells how long ago this is, from a Montana town with a population of 75. To begin college at Northwestern University in suburban Chicago. And you set off to walk this campus you have never laid eyes on before, and there on a slight rise atop a wide green sweep of spotless lawn stands the university library, Deering Library. Deering is a library like they don't build them anymore, similar to the original portion of Suzzolo Library on the University of Washington campus, the high, long roof with a pair of Gothic towers poking up at each end. Deering had architectural fame of a sort. The story was that Frank Lloyd Wright had driven past the Northwestern campus on Lakeshore Drive one day, looked at Deering Library with those Gothic towers nobly poking into the air, and said, "It looks like a pig on its back." I think what he really didn't like about it, though, was that Deering Library so much resembled a cathedral. And there's where Mr. Wright was wrong. There was nothing wrong with that resemblance. That library was a kind of cathedral. In several ways, it behaved like a cathedral. You step now into the reading room of Deering. You find that the banks of lights hang just above the tables. They hang all the way from the vaulted ceiling. They hang down what seems to be thousands of feet just for your reading convenience. They hang there like the watch fobs of the gods. You sit with your book there in the golden pool of reflection. The lens of light brings the printed words up into your eyes. The diarist Bruce Frederick Cummings has written of the desire every book has to be taken down and read, to live, to come into being in somebody's mind. Passing by out there on Lakeshore Drive, Frank Lloyd Wright is not listening to the desires of the books. but you are there in the great reading room, and you do. You hear them. You hear them. Now it is last summer, July, and this is Scotland, St. Andrews, the oldest university in Scotland, one of the most venerable in all of Great Britain. So venerable it takes a couple of days to do a graduation ceremony, so many customs and traditions are there to be observed. Be that as it may, the St. Andrews Library is a modern one, just a few years old, and going through a summer of teething pains. I walk in the first morning, and on floor after floor, I pass white-haired maintenance men in blue dust coats, staring silently, forlornly, down at the electrical trenches in the floor, into the mysterious entrails of wiring, to which they are going to have to figure how to hook up the new computer terminals. I step over to learn the catalog system. Its basic fact is that all books before 1906, whatever their topic, are in the basement. I venture down and immediately learn that the basement is a good 10 degrees cooler than the floors above. So whenever I want a book that was published before 1906, I had better put my coat on. I return to the catalog system. There is a set of bound volumes which catalogs some books. There is horizontal microfiche which catalogs other books. There is vertical microfiche cataloging still others. The back and forthing between the fiches has my eyes swimming. In none of the systems can I deduce how to find what I am after. Material about the Scottish working class in Western Scotland in the late 19th century. Somehow, I stumble onto a promising book with Toil in its title. Aha! There is a catalog computer terminal by now, added to the three prior systems, though I have been warned that only a fraction of the library's holdings are in it yet. But at least I have the magic word Toil, and at the punch of a few buttons, I'll get every title about the Scottish working class in whatever holdings have been computerized. I punch those buttons, and the screen fills with the promise of more screenfuls to come. I begin joyfully to take down the titles. Technology and Toil from 19th Century Britain. Toilers of the Linen Trade. But the third title is The Lady at Her Toilet. And it is all toiletry, cosmetic and other modes, after that. Eventually, perseverance and a saintly librarian did help me track down the books I was after, and now began the photocopy. The St. Andrews Library machine took only 5 pence pieces, which are about the size of an American 50-cent piece. I had hundreds of pages to do, so Carol said she'd go to the bank and get me some rolls of 5 pence pieces. Back she came not with rolls of coins, there was no such Scottish thing, but with bulging plastic bags of coins. Sort of like overloaded baggies. 105 pence pieces in each, a truly substantial sum of coins. I tried to get used to walking around lopsided with these coin bags in my pocket, and started feeding the 5 pences to the photocopy machine. About every other one, it spat back out. The problem here was that there are 2 kinds of 5 pence pieces. New ones minted when Britain went onto the decimal system a dozen or so years ago, and the old shilling pieces, which were simply declared to be worth 5 pence from then on. My heart sank along with my pockets. Were we going to have to double this bulk of coinage to do my photocopying? Sort out the hundreds of old coins from the hundreds of new? Well, my abiding belief is that machines are at least as eccentric as any of the rest of us. I looked around to be sure no one was watching, and began trying different deliveries of shilling pieces into the coin slot. I pretty quickly found that if I gave each shilling piece a little extra body English, kind of snapped it into the slot, the photocopy machine would gulp hard and swallow it. Of all the sounds that have ever come to me in libraries, that mechanical gulp of dismay was one of the most gratifying. Finally, down to the St. Andrew's Archives, in another part of the basement, I put my coat on, in search of letters of working-class immigrants who left that region of Scotland in the late 1880s, as the main characters of my next novel are to do. The archivist produces some letter collections for me, leads me into the reading room, and as I begin to sit down at a capacious table nicely lit by a window, he says, there's the matter of the air. The air in his Fifeshire burr. Does he mean error? Is this some Scotch Calvinist probing of my scholarly soul? Can he somehow mean the Scottish town of Ayr that Robert Burns wrote of? Old Ayr, whom never a town surpasses, for honest men and bonny lasses? That's cryptic, even from an archivist. But no, the air proved to be the air conditioning, which was blowing a gale at the end of the room I had contemplated sitting at. I took the archivist's point and established myself at the opposite end of the room, noticing as I did that there was a heavy tartan lap robe in the chair beside me. Within minutes, I was using that lap robe. And at lunchtime, I went home, and despite the fact that Scotland was sweltering under its hottest summer in a century, I put on a sweater under my sport jacket, came back, and got under the lap robe again. All the while cursing the St. Andrew's theory that the best method of preserving archives is to refrigerate them. But all the while, too, beginning to hearing the letters in front of me. During the storm, our ship swung like a cork. The screaming of the bosun's whistle, the yells of women and children when she swung over on her side, and tins, trunks, barrels, everything movable flew from side to side. We poor human things held on to the bedside like grim death. David McNeil, that voice, writing to his family in Scotland about his voyage to America as a steerage passenger in 1889. Another letter, McNeil has come by train across America to Colorado. Denver, he reports, looks as if it commenced last week and might be moved somewhere else next. Another McNeil letter. Clothing costs long prices in this America. As ever, as Deering Library was a quarter of a century before, as all the libraries in between have been, a library voice that was worth coming the distance to hear. What a writer, or at least this writer, listens for in a library is not always what anybody else wants to spend ear time on. Let me propound to you Doig's Law, which has not been tested quite as many times as Murphy's, but pretty close. Doig's Law, briefly put, is this. The more obscure the book, and the longer it has been taking up shelf space, and the less it has been used, the more valuable that book is to a writer named Doig. Efficiency experts and consultants are never going to be fond of Doig's Law. Yet it proves out time and again. In the stacks of the Shoreline Community College Library is an eccentric old volume by Edmund Pearson titled Queer Books, which a friend, who shall remain nameless, has rescued from purge after purge for me. Those of you who have read my last book, English Creek, may remember that there's an unusual 4th of July speech in the middle of that book, a speech without the usual rosy patriotic hue. To set the scene for that speech, I had the person who introduces the speaker do it this way. From the book, "This is a holiday particularly American. Sometimes if the person on the stump, such as I am at this moment, doesn't watch his enthusiasm, it can become a little too much so. I'm always reminded of the mock speech which Mose Skinner, the Will Rogers of his day, proposed for this nation's 100th birthday in 1876. Any person who insinuates in the remotest degree that America isn't the biggest and best country in the world, and far ahead of every other country in everything, will be filled with gunpowder and touched off." Those words of Mose Skinner, for some reason, whispered into Pearson's memory, and from his into mine, and from mine back into another book now, maybe to start a circle of murmur again. The Montana novel I'm writing now, the next in a trilogy about the McCaskill family of English Creek, goes back across the period from 1889 until just after World War I. Early in my research, I came across this paragraph in the Malone and Rader History of Montana. "Montana demonstrated its support of the war, World War I, by surpassing all other states in enlistment rates and draft quotas for the armed forces. 12,500 young Montana males volunteered for service. And due, apparently, to confused population estimates, the Selective Service drafted nearly 28,000 more. So nearly 40,000 men, about 10% of the state's population, not just the military age men, but of the total state population. About 10% of the population went to war, a rate of contribution that no other state even approached." That rate, of course, is astounding. Did Sparta ever send such a proportion of young Spartans off to its wars? If the U.S. had sent military forces to the Vietnam War at that rate, the total would have been 20 million soldiers. So, if I'm to write fiction about Montana during World War I, there is the colossal impact of that war to keep in mind. Again, an obscure voice from a library shelf spells it out for me. "Bighorn County in the World War," the title of the book said when I browsed across it in the UW's Northwest collection. A dark brown book about the size and shape of a high school annual with an eagle on the cover. Published by the local newspaper editor in the county seat of Hardin, out east of Billings. It wasn't really much of a book, and Bighorn County wasn't that much of a place. Then as now, its main claim to fame is the Custer Battlefield. But start through that book, with its oval photos of men in uniform and a paragraph apiece about their military service, and you begin to notice it goes on and on and on. There are 202 soldiers from that Montana stretch of grassland in this section of the book. And then you find there are even more. A section called "The Men Who Gave All." Clifford A. Ross contracted influenza and died 3 days later at Camp Dodge, Iowa. Daniel C. Shutty, while returning from a furlough in France, was killed in a train wreck between Paris and Brest. Emmett C. Smith, killed in action at Cantigny. Leonard J. Tudor, saw frontline service in France, died of wounds. Spencer D. Willey, saw service in France, taken ill with influenza, died in hospital of lobar pneumonia. Alfred Dent, fought in the Battle of the Argonne, died of wounds. Louis A. Gwinnett, killed in the Battle of the Marne. Stephen Chief at Night, entered the service at Salem Indian Training School in Oregon, died of tuberculosis at the Letterman General Hospital, San Francisco. Henry Clay Luckett, killed in action. Alexander Ross, killed in action at Chateau Thierry. Claude L. Blackburn, taken down with pneumonia, died in the base hospital, Camp Dodge, Iowa. Roy Cottrell, fought in the Meuse-Argonne offensive, killed in action. Ira M. Hathaway, enlisted in the Royal Air Force, killed in an accident to his plane outside London. Pete Peterson, died of pneumonia. Walter W. Colmar, killed by a high-explosive shell 2 days before the signing of the armistice. I hear them. I hear them. Fortunately, not all the heroic echoes that occur in a library have to be fatal ones. I like the heroic story of the WPA Federal Writers Project for Montana. During the 1930s, as part of that New Deal project, which also produced the famous state guidebooks, local people were put to work gathering local lore, often from their neighbors, sometimes even from themselves. In Montana, that gathering was done in every county, the material accumulated, and files of it ended up at the State Historical Society in Helena. But a day in 1943, a history professor from Montana State College in Bozeman, Merrill Burlingame, decided to ride along with another faculty member on a trip to Butte, where the other faculty member needed to look at some sort of river and stream study that had ended up in the warehouse of the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, which was phasing out of existence. As Merrill Burlingame told the story when I asked him for it, "We found the files we wanted near the loading door. Even closer to the loading door were 6 or 8 file cases marked Writer's Project. I investigated ever so lightly and began to drool. At that moment, the woman who appeared to be in charge appeared. We questioned her about the destination of these files, and she informed us that they would go to the Butte City dump in the morning. We backed her into whatever corner was available and told her she could not do that. She assured us in unprintable but perfectly clear English that she could and would. She told us that in an early stage of closing the records, she had sent a portion of these Writers' Project records to the Montana Historical Society, which was the approved depository. There, numerous writers of sorts, largely of the newspaper variety, had used generous portions of the materials without giving WPA the least credit. She didn't approve of that, and she would make sure that the Historical Society did not get one more folder of those records. The dump loomed, Burlingame goes on. We assured the good lady that nothing of that kind would happen at Montana State College, and that we would take special care that WPA did get credit. About 4:30, we got her permission to take them, but we were sure that speed was of the essence. We telephoned the college physical plant office and pressured them to provide a truck and driver in Butte as early as possible the following morning. And at that early hour, I came back with the driver. I am eternally thankful that he did. Nearly 40 years later, I was beginning to write a novel set in Montana in the 1930s, and in I came to the special collections at the Montana State University Library in Bozeman, and merrily ransacked those invaluable first-hand accounts of life during the Depression that Merrill Burlingame had heroically saved from the Butte dump. The people of my novel, English Creek, dance to a square dance call from out of those files. They remember great cattle roundups recounted therein. They enjoy at their 4th of July picnic the succulent, small spring frying chickens menued there. And yes, in my acknowledgments, I sing out a credit to the Montana Writers Project, of the WPA era. I mentioned earlier that obscure voices are often the most valuable ones to me in a library. There's another sort of library voice that I don't even know what to call, except maybe ventriloquism. I have this example. Now, like the rescued Montana Writers Project records, we are in Bozeman on a fine blue June day in 1977, when the five mountain ranges around the Gallatin Valley all are in view. In the MSU Library Special Collections, I am going through a box of payroll records of the Dogie Ranch, where my father worked for several years as a ranch hand and eventually foreman, and where my mother was the cook during lambing seasons. I find their names on the payroll records, and other names as well. One I recognize dimly, an old man who now is the swamper, the guy who sweeps the floor, at the grocery store in my hometown of White Sulphur Springs. The next day, too, is bright blue, and I am talking to the old man, Tony Hunault, in his dark bachelor room in White Sulphur Springs. "Yeah," Tony tells me in his Missourian voice. "Knowed your daddy since I landed into this country in 36 at shearing time at the Dogie. He staked me for my bedroll, I was so dead busted. Didn't have to do it, neither, but he done her." And even though Tony Hunault is dead by the time This House of Sky is published the next year, those words of his speak in its pages. Tony had told me, too, that I ought to go talk to so-and-so about some ranch topic or other. He knows A to Y about that. And that line speaks in the pages of English Creek last fall. And Tony had said to me about another man he and my father worked with there on the Dogie. He was an SOB on six wheels. And that line is sure to speak in the pages of some future book of mine. There is simply no telling how long Tony Hunault will go on speaking in my pages by way of library ventriloquism. There are just a couple of more stanzas I thought you might hear, and the first of them, I guess, is a world premiere of sorts. It's a few paragraphs from the book I'm writing now, the Montana novel that goes back to the late 19th century and World War I, and it's not been heard in public before. It is an early draft, far from final polish, but I thought by now, after hearing my vagaries about what a writer does in libraries, you could stand some reassurance that the material you provide does end up somewhere, in some more or less systematic way. So I thought I would read these few new paragraphs, then briefly show the library research that helped produce them. This is Scotland again. My narrator, Angus MacCaskill, and his chum, Robert Burns Barclay, are emigrating to America, to Montana. They are in line with the other steerage passengers a morning in 1889 on a dock at the port city of Greenock, at the mouth of the River Clyde. They're waiting to board the steamship James Watt, which is not a namesake of the unlamented former Secretary of the Interior, but of the Scottish inventor of the steam engine. The standing in line is tedious. Angus and his buddy are both of us 19 and green as the cheese of the moon, and trying our double damnedest not to show it. Angus himself is afraid of water, cannot swim, and there's 10 days of the Atlantic Ocean ahead. And here is what begins running through his mind. Awful what a person lets himself do to himself. There I stood in that Greenock dock, wanting more than anything else in this world not to step aboard that iron ship, and wanting just as desperately to do so. Oh, I knew what was wrestling in me. We had a book, Crowfoot's Transatlantic Emigrant's Guide, and my ailment was in it. Crowfoot was our instructor, that a shilling was worth 24 American cents, and what postal stamps cost there in the big country, and that when it was midnight in Scotland, the clocks of Montana were striking just 5 of the afternoon. Crowfoot told this, too. Do not emigrate in a fever, but consider the question in every aspect. The mother country must be left behind, the family ties, the old associations broken. Be sure that you look at the dark side of the picture, the broad Atlantic, the dusty ride to the great west, the scorching sun, the cold winter, coldest you ever experienced, and the hard work. But if you finally, with your eyes open, decide to emigrate, do it with no divided heart. Right advice, Angus goes on, to keep your heart in one pure peace, but easier seen than followed, at least in my case. I knew I oughtn't, but I turned and looked up the river, east up the great broad trough of the Clyde. East into yesterday, may as well say, for it was only the day before that the pair of us, Rob and I, had been hurled almost all the way across Scotland by train from Nethermuir into Glasgow. A further train across the Clyde Bridge, westward alongside mile upon mile of the river's tide flats and their smell. Then here came Greenock to us, all its shipyards and docks, the chimney stalks of its sugar refineries, its sharp church spires, and high, high above all, its municipal tower of crisp new stone, the color of pie crust. It took just that first look to know Greenock was a more going town than our old Nethermuir could be in 10 centuries. For night, we bedded where the emigration agent had advised, the model lodging house, which may have been a model of something, but lodging wasn't it. Then this morning, Greenock, true to reputation, waking into rain, but every Scotsman has seen rain before, and so off we set, to ask our way to the Cumbrae Lines Moorage, to the steamship James Watt, and to be told in a Clydeside gabble it took the both of us to understand, the Jemmy lads, ye want to gae doon to Patrick Street. And there at the foot of Patrick Street was the Albert Harbour. There was the green-funneled steam swimmer to America. There were the two of us. So, I am often asked, where does stuff like that come from? Where indeed? But here's where at least some of those phrases had their origin. We had a book, Crowfoot's Transatlantic Emigrant's Guide. Edinburgh, the National Library of Scotland, had emigration guides of the late 19th century. Not all of them as bombastic as the version I've given my young voyagers, but one of them does have that glorious line, do it with no divided heart. The pair of us had been hurled almost all the way across Scotland by train. St. Andrews, the basement, an old ordnance gazetteer of Scotland, tells me that my young man of 1889 would have ridden the Caledonian Railway to the port of Greenock. As a passenger line, the Caledonian takes high rank, its stations embracing all the 8 large towns of Scotland. Here came Greenock to us, all its shipyards and docks, the chimney stalks, and so on. Greenock itself, the Watt Library, with its historic photos of Greenock in its heyday, before a channel was dredged in the River Clyde upstream to Glasgow. We bedded in the model lodging house, St. Andrews, the basement again, a pocket history and guide to the Scottish town of Brechin, which had such an imaginatively named place to stay, which may have been a model of something, but lodging wasn't it. That same pocket history provides the information that out of 3,276 men who stayed overnight sometime during that year, no fewer than 1,100 went to bed under the influence of liquor. Off we set to the steamship James Watt, Glasgow, the Mitchell Library, where from the old Lloyd's registers of ships, Carol put together for me the dimensions and speed and deck layouts and even the color scheme of a typical emigrant steamship of the time. To be told in a Clydeside gabble, "The jemmy lads, ye want to gae doon to Barrack Street." Glasgow and the Mitchell Library again. Here I was trying to get at the fact that as soon as you leave home, the world begins to sound different. And in Scotland, the residents of Glasgow and the nearby towns along the Clyde River have the reputation of sounding mysterious even to other Scots, which is saying a lot. The Glasgow film Gregory's Girl was dubbed with a new soundtrack for American audiences. Anyway, in trying to hear the Glaswegian dialect for the sake of this scene in my novel, I came onto a study of Scottish dialects which told me that a distinctive Glasgow sound is what's called a glottal stop, a kind of swallowing of the letter T. The example given was the Glaswegian who introduces himself to you, "My name is Pat Patterson, with two T's." And so from visiting nearby Greenock and finding in the library material there that the Clydeside steamships for America had left from the Albert Harbor at the foot of Patrick Street, I had my chance to put that half-baffling bit of dialect into my character's ears. I want to end this talk in the next few minutes on a note such as you might find in a love song. For the fact seems to be, as I look back over my behavior as a writer, that I'm infatuated with libraries. There's more to it than that. There always is in affairs of the heart, divided or otherwise. Time after time, I have loved libraries not just for themselves, but for the company they keep. I think of the Alaska Historical Library in Juneau during my Sea Runners research, of how I would take a break there by going out onto a balcony of that building above Juneau and watching the white cruise ships come up Gastineau Channel between the dark timbered avalanche of the Alaskan mountains. It was like stepping directly from the library to a mountaintop. And I remember more years ago, after a morning spent in the reading room of the British Museum, a lunchtime. On the other side of Great Russell Street was a pub which shrewdly called itself the Museum Tavern. You can hear the domestic dialogues that choice of name created. "And where have you been this long while?" "Where have I been? I was in the museum." Well, in I went, sat at the end of the bar, ordered a smoked salmon sandwich and a half of bitter. Next to me sat a huge character who was chatting with the bartender and his young helper. I sat, sipping and munching, in that snug harbor so close by the British Museum's ocean of books. The bartender went to tend customers at the far end of the bar. The huge character leaned in on the young helper and said, "You've got the money now?" The young helper nodded nervously. The huge character ordered, "Give it me with the change for my next pint." I realized that I was seeing a loan shark at work, and I fervently hoped that he was going to go on ignoring me, the invisible American. The young helper grew even more nervous. Instead of passing his payoff to the shark with the change for a drink, he turned his body and shoved the money across the bar. The shark snatched it and disappeared just as the bartender looked down the bar, knowing he had seen something happen. I went back to the reading room of the British Museum with the reminder that not all the world's stories were in its books. And I think back again to Scotland last summer, to Glasgow. The people of Glasgow, the Glaswegians, have a reputation as the Cockneys or the Brooklynese of Scotland. And while British person after British person told us we would find Glasgow generally hospitable enough in a raffish kind of way, for heaven's sake, Carol and I, we naive library types, must never go into the pubs in that city of hard men. I spent a first morning in Glasgow's Mitchell Library,
a sleek enterprise which proclaims itself the largest public reference library in Europe, and likely is. Carol met me and said, "I think I found us a lunch place." It was a mere half block away, and it was called the Ritz Bar, and of course it was a pub. In we went to a place of gleaming dark wood and gorgeous high pressed tin ceiling, and the most orderly of clientele, and impeccable service, which included the motherly cook coming out of the kitchen to ask us, "Is the soup all right, dears?" Fearsome Glasgow pubs, eh? May they take over the world. I don't know what you make of incidents such as these, but I suggest that it's no coincidence that memorable watering holes so often come to mind together with memorable libraries. After all, aren't librarians the bartenders of information? Behind your polished wood, don't you deal with all manner of customers who step in through that door from the street? Aren't strange concoctions ordered up from you? Don't you see almost every sort of human behavior and begin regularly to recite the ancient prayer that must have originated in a pub somewhere? "Please, Lord, not on my shift." And don't you preside over shelves of intoxicating items, some of which are never opened until the day a bearded customer comes in and asks, "Do you have a brand called Doig's Law?" And at closing time, isn't there a cosmic chorus of librarians, all of you saying wearily to yourselves, "At least I helped humankind make it through one more day"? That's what I hear.
Thank you immensely for this. The Merriam name, of course, is a mighty one in the history of Montana writing. To have this award, which carries the name of the man who began the extraordinary literary lineage of this campus and this town, is to feel chosen indeed. I take it that the only conceivable reason for asking a writer to talk out loud is to try find out what he's up to. Insofar as I know what I'm up to, I'll concentrate here for the next 20 minutes or so. I assume you all have homes to go to. I'll concentrate on a few of the ingredients of my work, how a writer, or at least this writer, tries to draw on the West, and in my case that mostly means Montana, tries to search out elements to make books of. The makings of a book, and so far I have made 5 2/3 books, which are set either here in Montana or out along the coast where I now live, the makings of a book can be mystifying in more ways than one. I think all of us who write, who spend our lives putting black on white, ought to look at our effort every so often in the light of an incident told by a writer I have admired all of my own writing life. Isaac Dinesen. As you may know, Isaac Dinesen is the pen name of Karen Blixen, the Danish writer who died in 1962. She has received some much-deserved attention in recent years with the marvelous biography of her by Judith Thurman, and, need I say, from the film of Out of Africa, which starred Meryl Streep and Robert Redford. For once, I felt the world had come around to my opinion, because I've long thought Out of Africa is one of the most lovely books of this century. On her coffee farm in Kenya, in the teens and twenties of this century, as Isaac Dinesen worked into the nights on the manuscript which became Out of Africa, her Kikuyu houseboy, Kamonte, would stand along the wall watching. One evening, Kamonte announced to her that he did not think her writing could ever amount to anything. Dinesen records, "I laid down my paper and asked him, 'Why not?' I now found that he had prepared himself for this." Kamonte stood with a copy of the Odyssey itself behind his back, and here he laid the blue-bound book on the table. "Look, Masabu," he said, "this is a good book. It hangs together from the one end to the other. Even if you hold it up and shake it strongly, it has not come to pieces. The man who has written it is very clever." "But what you write," Kamandi went on, both with scorn and with a sort of friendly compassion, "what you write is some here and some there. When the people forget to close the door, it blows about, even down on the floor, and you get angry. It will not be a good book." Isaac Dennison continues, "I explained to him that in Europe, the people would be able to fix it all up together." "Will your book then be as heavy as this?" Kamandi asked, weighing the Odyssey. When he saw that I hesitated, he handed the blue-bound book to me in order that I might judge for myself. "No," I said, "it will not, but there are other books in the library that are lighter." "Then will your book be as hard as this one?" Kamandi asked. I said it was expensive to make a book so hard. Dennison concludes, "A few days later, I heard Kamandi explain to the other houseboys that in Europe, the book which I was writing could be made to stick together, and that with terrible expense, it could even be made as hard as the Odyssey," which he again displayed. He himself, however, did not believe that it could be made blue. So that's one method of diagnosing a book, and with more common sense behind it than other reviewers and critics sometimes can muster. Maybe more than I'll be able to in trying to identify the ingredients of my own works. If I'm reading my own books right, though, it is the working West that first of all interests me, the everyday craft of making a living out here. In the course of my first novel, The Sea Runners, I got in touch with a park ranger up at Sitka, Alaska, who's an expert on the carpentry and shipbuilding that went on there when Alaska was still Russian America. He gave me not only the working details I needed, but he also read out for me a quote from the English poet William Blake. "Art and science cannot exist but in minutely organized particulars." When I'd finished blinking over the literary and philosophical bent of park rangers these days, probably something he had needed to get through the era of James Watt, it occurred to me that the quote explains much of what I like about certain books set in the West. There's the line in Jim Welch's immortal novel, Winter in the Blood, the description of a lazy bale piler the narrator is working with in a hayfield. He had learned to give the illusion of work, even to the point of sweating as soon as he put his gloves on. Now, I've worked with that guy up in the Dupuyer country. Anybody who's ever been on a haying job probably has. The truth in that, the artistic exactness, the minutely organized particulars, radiates right out. In my own case as a writer, I find an oxygen, a breath of life, when I get involved in gathering lore from the working people of the West. Quite a lot of it has been gathered here at the Mansfield Library. Much of the Forest Service lore, for instance, that went into the forest fire scene in English Creek, I found in Dale Johnson's domain of archives. And Missoula and this university make some appearances in the book I'm finishing up now, the last novel of the trilogy that began with Dancing at the Rascal Fair and English Creek. A quick world preview here, about a paragraph's worth. My narrator, Jick McCaskill, went to forestry school here on the GI Bill after World War II, and here he tells of meeting another student whose name was Shirley. "She was a Theta and a theater major, and ordinarily our paths would not have crossed in 100 years. But Shirley had a taste for life on the edge of campus, as did I in those after-war years. I hung around with some of the married veterans who lived in prefab housing called Splinterville, and at one Saturday night party there, the two of us found ourselves at the keg of Highlander beer at the same time. It surely tested me out in a voice as frisky as the rest of her. "You're the smoke jumper, aren't you?" I surprised myself by smiling a smile as old as creation, and cracking back to her, "Yeah, but that ain't all." It happened fast after that. I try to blend library resources with actuality that perhaps hasn't reached the library shelves yet. For instance, English Crick has in it A Haying Season, probably the only novel published in recent time that can make that claim. A haying season of the late 1930s, when the haying machinery still was run mostly by horses instead of horsepower. When I was a kid in Montana, just after World War II, my dad was a haying contractor every summer. His crews largely put up hay in that old workhorse way. So I did have my own memories to bring in and use. But I had to admit to myself, those days when I was a red-headed kid in a hayfield are getting to be a long time ago in a galaxy far away. So to add other memories to my own, I ran little classified ads in the weekly newspapers in southwestern Montana here, asking to hear from anybody who had worked on a haying crew in the late 1930s in the Big Hole. I heard from about a dozen people, from mower men and scatter rakers, to a woman who took in laundry from the hay crews in Wisdom. I wanted details, did I? The laundry lady had them. She wrote me, "I charge 15 cents for shirts, washed, ironed, mended, loose buttons sewed on, 10 cents for a pair of shorts, 10 cents for an undervest, 5 cents for a handkerchief, and 10 cents for a pair of socks. Any kind of pants was 25 cents for washing and pressing." And with her laundry details come the larger memories, the stories of the people and their times. The washer lady went on to me, "I think of Joe. When I shrunk his expensive woolen underwear, I thought he would never come back. But every Saturday, he would bring me his 50 cents worth of laundry anyway. I think of Charlie Williams, an old-time cowboy who brought me a green silk shirt with the request I embroider a horseshoe on the back. Now that, too, was a disaster, but he still came. I think of the two shady ladies who came to town for the haying season. They, too, brought me their laundry, and I remember one of them, on a beautiful summer day, asking me how I could smile." Plainly enough, then, I'm interested in writing about the everyday craft of making a living in the American West, not just on farms and ranches, for the novel I'm writing now has a couple of characters who are newspaper people, from Missoula, as a matter of fact, going about their jobs. There's even a brief appearance by a librarian. But in any case, whatever the occupations, I'm trying to get at the West behind the cowboy myth, the West of Wallace Stegner and Norman MacLean, and Mary Clearman Blue and Louise Erdrich, of Craig Leslie and Gretel Ehrlich, of Bill Kittredge, of James Welch and Leslie Marmon Silko. Books set here on the West Side of America haven't always given attention to the workaday life and the valid voices of our region. A romantic version that one scholar has called The Cowboys Without the Cows got underway about 90 years ago with The Virginian, Owen Wister's famous novel. The Virginian began a lineage of books that might be called Wisterns. In a Western, a bad guy insults a good guy. In The Virginian, the actual insult is, "You son of a blank." And the good guy dangerously drawls back, "When you call me that, smile." But that's about all that does go on in a Western. None of the guys, good or bad, ever seems to do a lick of everyday work. Milk a cow, churn butter, plant a potato. You get the impression that somewhere just out of sight, there must be a catering service, maybe someplace around Omaha, comes out west and feeds everybody, does the chores. Nonsensical as that sort of portrait of the western half of America is, it does have consequences. It fudges the terms of life in much of the actual American West. That this is a big, complicated, fragile, contentious part of the country, which requires a lot of work to make a living from its land. That is the West behind the cowboy myth. The West I'm trying to work toward in my own writing. So, those are at least a handful of the makings of books such as mine, and doubtless of many other writers out here as well. It is my utter belief that writers of caliber can ground their work in specific land and lingo, and yet be writing of that larger country, life. Specific geographies, but galaxies of imaginative expression. We've seen them both exist in William Faulkner's postage stamp size Yucknapatawpha County, and in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's nowhere village of Macondo, dreaming in its 100 years of solitude. This big western end of our country, being the worthwhile place it still is, there seems to be incentive for writers to use their local earth as a mighty base. I think we're at least trying, as Isaac Dennison's houseboy Camonte wanted, to make our pages hang together from one end to the other. With a little luck, maybe some of them will even turn out to be good enough we can bind them in blue. Thanks for coming out tonight.
Or could go back.
Guitar maker Paul Reed Smith. Mr. Schultz, when it became public knowledge that CBS wanted to sell the Fender Musical Instrument Company, did you have offers from musicians who use the Fender guitar to buy the company?
No, we did not, but we had many phone calls from these musicians saying, please do something to keep the Fender name alive and to keep the Fender products forthcoming.
Bill Schultz, the president of the Fender Musical Instrument Company, which this week bought itself from CBS, and promises to go on building the Fender Stratocaster.
And for this evening, that's All Things Considered.
Help tonight from member stations WBEZ in Chicago and KQED in San Francisco.
Our director is Bill Abbott, the editor Barbara Durr. The program was produced by Mark Willen with help from Moira Rankin and George Achebes.
Our technical director is Leszek Wojcik. The audio engineers Trish Gordon, Bill Corgile, Jason Stelluto, Jim Smith, and Eileen Griffin. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Good evening for All Things Considered.
Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for historical reporting, the Pew Memorial Trust, TRW Incorporated, developer of advanced space electronics and information systems, and for the coverage of events in Central America, the Ford Foundation. This program is a production of NPR, which is solely responsible for its content. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You're tuned to KUOW Public Radio for the Sound, Seattle. Time now, 4:59, and it's currently 60 degrees. Thank you. portion of A Prairie Home Companion is brought to you in part by Ivor's Captain's Table on Elliott Bay.